It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Are you one of those people who checks off everything on their daily to-do list? Well, increasingly, American workers are those kinds of people. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, August the 3rd. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Our lead story today comes in the form of a formula. It is widgets produced per hour worked. That is almost literally how the Labor Department comes up with its quarterly report on worker productivity in this economy, said report landed this morning. And in fact, we were all a little bit more productive in the second quarter than we were in the first. 3.7% more productive at an annual rate, should you be curious. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports to get us going here at the top of the show, both key components of that formula, how much stuff we're making and how long it has taken us to do it, are moving in the right direction.
The Labor Department says worker output rose in the second quarter. That's in large part because economic growth has been picking up.
Not only were consumers spending, businesses were investing, but you also saw a rebound in inventories.
That's Sarah House, senior economist at Wells Fargo. She says all of those factors are a sign that workers are producing more products. For instance, if consumers spent more,
consumers had to spend on something that was produced. So even if that was a meal at a restaurant, the airline flight, that was a product being offered to consumers.
Meanwhile, the report said that it's taking workers less time to make all those products. Average weekly hours worked fell.
We're getting to a point where those average weekly hours are basically back towards where they were pre-COVID. That's great for these employees who have been so overworked the past few years.
House says productivity numbers are volatile, and they're often revised later. George Perks, global macro strategist at Bespoke Investment Group, says the decline in hours worked could also be reflecting the fact that the workforce is getting older.
That is going to shift towards more people with part-time work, fewer people with very high hour jobs per week.
Rising productivity can be a good sign for inflation. The Labor Department also looked at how much the production of one product is costing employers in terms of hourly pay. That number has cooled down by a lot.
That looks to validate the story that high inflation from the post-pandemic period was not a structural thing, but was a very quick cyclical shock of inflation. And we're now reverting back towards the kind of 2% inflation environment that we were used to before COVID struck.
And if productivity continues to rise, it'll cost even less to make things. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
We got the latest read on the state of American manufacturing, and you can pick your term for it here if you want to. Contracting, softening, weakening are a couple that come to mind. The Institute for Supply Management, which does a survey of manufacturers to come up with something called the Purchasing Managers Index, PMI in the vernacular, it says we are now in the ninth straight month of contraction. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains what that means for the rest of this economy.
Of the 18 manufacturing sectors highlighted in July's PMI report, all but two were slowing down. Daryl West is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
I mean, the sectors that actually are growing were petroleum as well as furniture. There remains a very robust demand there.
People are still glamming up their homes, and the hot summer increasing electricity demand, plus summer travel, helped out the oil industry.
But in virtually every other area, apparel, plastics, electronics, food, and transportation, the manufacturing activity actually was down.
Some of that has to do with manufacturers' ongoing struggle to predict demand. Consumers are still spending, but who knows for how long. But all the caution in manufacturing doesn't necessarily signal a broader economic downturn, according to Tom Derry, CEO of the Institute for Supply Management. He says that's because manufacturing only makes up about 11 to 12% of U.S. GDP. Most of the country's economic output is in the services sector.
And its relatively strong performance appears to have held us up out of the recessionary period that otherwise we might have expected just on the manufacturing numbers alone.
Derry says despite all the softness, slowing, contraction, etc., manufacturers are ready to ramp things up if they start to see the demand for it. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street today down again. I would wager, though, no wah-wahs today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You can cover an economy data point by data point, right? The various short-term twists and turns. And we do some of that. But it's good, we think, to take the longer view, too, to talk to people over time about what they see out there, big and small businesses mostly, but also observers and analysts. Mohamed El-Aryan is one of the latter. He's the president of Queen's College Cambridge, also currently the chief economic advisor at Allianz. Dr. El-Aryan, welcome back to the program, sir.
Thanks for having me.
You've said a number of times, I think, and I don't want to get into the whole soft landing debate, but you have said that we can avoid a recession in this country if the Fed does not over-tighten, that is to say, raise interest rates too much farther. I guess my question is, how are we going to know when the Fed may possibly be over-tightening?
That is a great question, and that's where the balance of risk comes in. So imagine that you are at a stable 3% inflation rate. Mm-hmm. And the choices you have are the following. One is go to 2% and risk tipping the economy into recession, or alternatively, live with 3% and avoid a recession. You know, that's the sorts of things that the Fed is going to be forced to think about towards the tail end of this year. And it's going to be tested. And it's not an easy decision. But I think that if the Fed was able and willing to swallow its pride, it would probably opt for the first option, which is better for the economy. Live with a slightly higher inflation rate, but don't tip the economy into recession.
It's no small thing, as you know, for the Federal Reserve, which is, first of all, a hide-bound and tradition-bound organization, but it picked 2% for a reason. It has stuck with that for a very long time. Are you saying now that they ought to just come out and say, you know what, never mind, 3%, we're good?
So let's talk about why it picked 2%. It picked 2% because the other central banks picked 2%.
Right,
and
right.
It then chose 2% because 2% seemed appropriate. There's nothing scientific about 2%. This is a judgment. The reality is that the economy has changed, that the supply side has become more problematic, and that a 2% inflation rate may be too low. The problem, as you rightly say, is how do you change your inflation target when you have not met it for such a long time? And I think the only way you can do that is by promising us 2% down the road, 2025, 2026, and seeing whether we can live with a stable inflation rate that is slightly higher.
Let me ask you about something you just said. You used the word judgment, and I want to ask about judgment and the use of data. The Fed, as you know, and Powell says it, and Bernanke has said it, and Yellen, Ed, they've all said it. We're a data-dependent organization. You have said you worry about the Fed becoming too data-dependent, excessively data-dependent. And I wonder what you think the Fed is supposed to do, because surely we don't want the central bank just sticking a finger up in the wind and saying, yeah, this feels good.
No, absolutely. The big difference between this Fed and the Bernanke Fed and the Yellen Fed is not that they are data dependent or not data dependent. They're all data dependent. But the other two had a medium-term view of the economy. This Fed is excessively data dependent, which means that it's policy actions are a function of backward-looking data. So step back and think of this. The data is backward-looking, mm-hmm. and your tools operate with a lag. So at some point, it is like driving the car looking at your rearview mirror. You cannot be data-dependent without also having a view of how the economy is going to evolve over the medium term. And we don't have that. And there's a very good reason for that. It's an embarrassing reason, which is that, as you know, the Fed adopted a new monetary framework in 2021 that was suited for the world of yesterday and is not suited for the world of today or the world of tomorrow.
As the Fed looks forward out of its windshield, though, and as you sit in the back seat and look, I guess, to really kill that metaphor, what are you seeing in this economy? I mean, most indications are that things are pretty good.
Exactly. And most indications are that they shouldn't have hiked the last time. And there's a risk right now that they are going to overdo it. This economy is doing just fine. And the last thing we should risk right now is tipping into recession. One of the problems of having inflation too high for too long is that you've eaten away at the purchasing power of people. Mm-hmm. And that's particularly problematic for those on low income. So the last thing you want to do is increase income and security. Can you imagine first you hit them with an inflation shock and then you take their income away? That would have significant distributional effects.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go. You and we talked about this on the program in the beginning of the pandemic, and as inflation started to go up, and you were deeply worried about the Fed waiting too long, and now it seems you're worried about the Fed going too far. Overall, how do you think the Fed has done in this inflation crisis?
I think it completely mischaracterized inflation as transitory initially. So that's on the negative side. Second, when it acknowledged it wasn't transitory, it didn't move fast enough. That's also on the negative side. Then it really moved quickly. And let's not forget, we had four consecutive hikes of 0.75%. We've never had that in history. So that's on the positive side. And now it has a big test. Will it have the courage and the vision to settle on the right inflation rate and the right functioning of the economy? Or will it just follow what I think is an outmoded inflation target and tip this economy into recession? So the final grade is still outstanding.
Mohammed Alarian is the president of Queen's College, Cambridge, used to be at PIMCO, currently the chief economic advisor at Allianz. Dr. Alarian, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it as always.
Thank you.
It's not an often noted part of higher education in this country, but colleges and universities here are businesses. Not-for-profit businesses, for the most part, to be sure, but businesses nonetheless. So income, which is to say revenue, matters. According to the Cato Institute, last year the State Department denied the highest percentage of international student visa applications in decades, 35% denial rate. Those students represent something like $26 billion worth of lost tuition over 4 years. Again, that's according to Cato. So as a new school year approaches, Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall reports on the economics of foreign students.
COVID-19 gutted international student exchange, but that's changing. Marka Martel with the Institute of International Education says in 2022, the number of international students was nearly a million.
What we've seen is a fortunate return and international students really coming back to U.S. classrooms.
But the return could have been even stronger, the Cato Institute's David Beer.
This is by far the most number of denials that we've ever seen.
Some 220,000 students who colleges had already admitted, including an increasing number from India. U.S. officials in India deny visas more frequently.
There's a high rate of, I would call it, suspicion towards the applicants there and their desire to want to immigrate permanently to the United States.
Beer says the U.S. is leaving talent and money on the table. Miriam Feldblum with the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration says one way foreign students benefit schools is when a class may have just a few American students enrolled.
But if there's five international students as well, then that class goes on.
And international students pay higher tuition, says University of Houston economist Stephen Craig, which is also good for schools.
The rest of the world is working as hard as they can to copy our higher education system.
He says they also contribute research, especially in STEM, benefiting U.S. innovation. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Coming up,
here comes a magical show of gelato and sorbet.
I mean, it doesn't get any better than that, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 66 points, 0.2%, 35,215. Told you it wasn't going to be the Wawa's, by the way. The NASDAQ down 13 points, 10%, 13,959. No, not a tough guess, guy. The S&P 500 retreated 11 points, 0.25%, 45-1 there. Kimberly was talking to us about the state of manufacturing. So let us check the Wall Street performance of some big American stuff makers today, shall we? Clorox, which posted expectations-beating earnings yesterday, surged nearly 9%. Cummins, which makes engines, fell 7.5% on missing earnings. Go figure that one out. Amazon reported an 11% boost in second quarter earnings after the closing bell, beating expectations. For more than a year, Amazon, as we've told you, has been in cost-cutting mode, eliminating more than 25,000 jobs. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note up 4.18%. You're listening to Marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Even with inflation, 100,000 American dollars still get you some very nice, you know, rich people things. This year's version of the Porsche Boxster Spider, maybe, or a private jet rental, perhaps, or, all right, wait, how about this one? How about citizenship in the Caribbean nation of Antigua and Barbuda? Yes, for a non-refundable donation of $100,000 to the National Development Fund there, you too can be an Antiguan citizen, courtesy of what's known as a citizen by investment program offered by several Caribbean countries, also, though, by places like Turkey and Malta. These kinds of citizenship opportunities have traditionally attracted wealthy people from Russia and the Middle East, for instance. Since the pandemic, though, there has been a new and growing clientele, Americans, and more specifically, Americans with Bitcoin. Marketplace's Matt Levin has this one.
There's a lot competing for your attention on the expo floor at Bitcoin 2023. That's North America's largest Bitcoin convention, which took place in Miami earlier this year. There's the Bitcoin-themed Back to the Future DeLorean and the Bitcoin-themed Cornhole competition. But a modest booth in the back of the expo hall is attracting its own steady stream of attendees with a minor Bitcoin celebrity.
Katie Ananina, but Nobody knows me by my last name.
Why does no one know you by your last name?
Everybody knows me as Katie the Russian.
Ananina is the CEO of Plan B Passports, a company that helps Bitcoiners find legal residence or citizenship in another country. And since 2020, she's been increasingly popular with Americans.
We've seen a huge spike when the first election took place because half the country is unhappy with the results. Then when COVID hit, a lot of people realized they don't have as much freedom as they wish they had. So they decided to hedge against their government again.
And Anina says she serves hundreds of clients a year, lots of Texans and Floridians she's steering mostly to the Caribbean. It's not just that Bitcoiners fear that the country is falling apart. It's fear that Uncle Sam eventually will go after them for owning Bitcoin.
And in order for you to be able to get out, you need an exit strategy. And again, that's where Second Passport is the ultimate hedge.
More than 20 countries offer citizenship by investment programs, or CBIs for short. They've been around since the 1980s and traditionally attract very rich people. Kristen Surak is a professor at the London School of Economics who studies these programs.
I had an interviewee say that, you know, she thought of buying yet another Mercedes.
But instead, she splurged on citizenship in Dominica, an island nation in the Caribbean with about 70,000 people. Like many citizenship by investment programs, there's two routes to Dominica citizenship: a one-time donation of $100,000 or a real estate investment of $200,000, typically in a condo. A condo you might never need to visit.
In some cases, you never even have to go to the country. And for the most part, most investors don't want to go. They're looking for the travel options or the insurance.
The insurance part is basically if things go to hell in the U.S., then yeah, you can take your yacht or private jet to your other home country. The travel part is the bigger lure. Some Caribbean nations have visa-free travel arrangements with the U.K. and the E.U. If you're wondering if this is all just some way to avoid the IRS, Temple University professor Peter Spiro says it's not.
As long as you hold U.S. citizenship, you're taxed on your worldwide income, and having another citizenship doesn't help you at all.
Spiro says many countries that offer these programs often don't have much in the way of domestic industry, aside from tourism.
These countries, because they're small, the revenues that they're generating from the citizenship programs is significant relative to their GDP.
But the programs aren't without controversy. Spiro says some critics just find the idea of buying citizenship kind of gross.
It's not that this person knows the country, that this person is attached to this country, that they've spent some time in this country. All those traditional historical trappings of citizenship go out the window.
Several citizenship by investment programs have also come under scrutiny for allegedly working with criminals. The UK recently revoked its visa-free travel arrangement with Dominica, citing security concerns with its CBI program. And there's often not great accounting for how the revenue is actually spent. But that doesn't really bother Katie and Anina or many of the libertarian-leaning Bitcoiners she works with.
Now, where exactly does money go? We will never find out.
And if you're wondering if there's perhaps a cheap citizenship by investment option, maybe one you can buy around next year's election, there isn't. I asked. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Running a business is hard work. Even besides dealing with all the economic data that we tell you about every week, inflation and interest rates and consumer this and consumer that, sometimes, most times probably, making your small business work just comes down to sticking to it, to perseverance and resilience and some luck as well. We have been talking to Uli Nasibova for a couple of years now about the ups and also about the downs of running her own gelato shop.
When the pandemic first started, you know, your survival instincts kick in. Failure was not an option. I wanted to fight back. I also made the decision to close down my two brick-and-mortar gelato stores, or gelaterias, as I call them. The economics were not making a lot of sense to keep them going. And these two stores were such a big part of my journey. I knew closing them was going to be difficult for me to process. So to distract myself from the emotional side of things, and because I was building my revenues back up from basically zero, I just started listening to podcasts, primarily business podcasts. And there was one particular episode of a podcast that I love very much. And the founder on that website, Max Quabro of Petit Pot,
he did everything right. He was pitching to these investors. He knew his numbers. He was just doing an excellent job. He didn't get any funding. So I reached out to Max, and then Max offered me a ticket to this natural food expo in Anaheim, Expo West. And through this Expo West, I also pitched to a lot of groceries. So I had brought the suitcase packed with dry ice, and I would open it back up and like, here comes a magical show of gelato and sorbet, my beautiful packaging. And I am now supplying to Bristol Farms here in Southern California. I have spent the last 2 weekends doing demos at 4 of their stores and meeting their Saturday and Sunday shoppers and telling the story of my brand, talking about how each flavor came to life because each pint has its own story. I'm so happy that through happenstance, luck, but also a lot of perseverance and just like reaching out to people and not being shy, I created this opportunity for my business. It's definitely something that I really needed in the moment.
That's Uli Nasabova. Uli's Gelato is her shop out here in LA if you happen to come to town. Even if you don't, though, we do still want to hear what is up in your economy. You can tell us at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, some data from the Centers for Disease Control that we saw on Axios today. The uninsured rate in this country, health insurance to be clear, hit an all-time low earlier this year, 7.7% of Americans without coverage. So that's the good. The maybe not so good comes in two parts. First of all, a lot of the pandemic era protections and coverages are expiring, most particularly expanded Medicaid. Also, 7.7% of Americans without health insurance, as low as that is still like 22 million people. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Comes to us from Threadneedle Street in the city. That's the address in the business district in the City of London of the Bank of England, which this morning raised its key interest rate for the 14th straight time. I probably should have asked Muhammad Al-Arian about that, huh? John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.